I just want to finish this session with something really important. I think all of the speakers have talked about that, and all of you as well. We need resistance. We need resistance for the social movements, from the grassroots levels. We need resistance from the women, from youth, from the peasants, small farmers, as some people call it. We need resistance from the workers. We need resistance from the consumers. All of us in one boat. We need to fight together. And this is the big thing. Doha was stopped, was put on hold, as it is, because of the resistance of the grassroots movements, because the joint forces of all the social movements. In Brazil, the MST, the landless movement, have been able to take the land back because the union, because the solidarity amongst them. I think Cuba is an example as well of that, or is the society working together towards a main goal. So I think this is important. Consumers, workers, social movements, women, all of us need to be in one goal, resisting the corporate model and stopping the governments, the UK and Europe, supporting corporations, promoting GMOs, promoting Monsantos and Cargill's and Syngentas of the world, that they are not the solution for the hunger of this world. So I want to leave with that.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. For those of you that were able to make this morning's seminar, I'm sure, like me, you thought it was extremely interesting and a lot of very positive things came out of it. But we've now got just under a two-hour session. I'm Rob Flello. I'm the Member of Parliament for Stoke-on-Trent South, that very well-known rural community, but nevertheless, I and my constituents do eat, and therefore these issues are just as valid, and if not in many respects more so, than a rural constituency. I'm delighted that somewhere where she's hiding, Baroness Miller is here as well, who's the co-chair with myself of the All-Party Agroecology Group. And I'm even more delighted that we have a panel of speakers this afternoon, who I will introduce in just a moment. We're going to have about an hour's worth of contribution from our speakers, with about 20 minutes from each of the speakers. I know that you will have burning desire to interrupt and ask really important and searching questions, but if I can ask you just to keep your questions perhaps noted on a piece of paper till the hour is over, and then there will be the opportunity to ask questions of the panel for a good period of time, taking us up to 4 o'clock. So hopefully the ground rules are sorted and we can get underway. First speaker will be Dr. Julia Wright. Julia is the Deputy Director of the Centre for Agroecology and Food Security at the University of Coventry. Our second speaker will be Mark Hodkinson, who is a source. Sorry?
He's coming to the.
Oh, right, okay, I've written two next to both. That was really helpful of me. Our second speaker will not be Dr. Mark, it'll be Professor Martin Mortimer, who's head Department of Plant Sciences at the University of Liverpool. And our third speaker will be Mark Hodkinson, soil scientist and agronomist, who will be giving a farming perspective. So those are our three speakers for this afternoon. I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully your phones are on silent or off, as you prefer. And if you do need to come and go as the hour progresses, if I could ask you to sort of quietly slip away and come back. You may notice people coming in and then floating away. There'll be members of Parliament and members of the House of Lords who are a little bit like butterflies that alight upon a leaf, have a little nibble and fly off again to the next leaf. So don't worry about it, it's all normal behaviour. And we'll be beginning business at 2:30. So there'll be a bell that goes off at 2:30 to signify that the prayers have started, and a few minutes after that there'll be another bell to say that the business is underway. Again, don't be alarmed by the bells ringing. If there is any sort of emergency, you'll know that it is, because I'll be running out of that door there, so enjoy. Without further ado, if I can ask Dr. Julia Wright to begin. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So thank you for inviting me to speak here. I'm from that well-known rural city, Coventry. That's where I'm working at the moment, in the new Research Centre for Agroecology and Food Security. There's some leaflets over there about this centre, if anyone would like to see them afterwards. So I've been asked to speak about democratising agricultural research, and I kind of have to say that in the UK there isn't a lot of it at the moment, or internationally, so I'm going to talk about my own research experiences. and what we're actually doing, and show how it's sort of how this idea of democratisation has evolved, and maybe get, shed some light as to what it means and what it doesn't mean. So, democratising agriculture research, how far we can we go, and who are we anyway? And that sounds a bit existential, but bear with me. So I'm going to just have an give an overview of the transition in research for development over the last, say, 30 years. And just to start with, you know, as most of you in here probably know, farmers are researchers anyway. In fact, we all are in a way. We all innovate and we all experiment and we all test things out in our daily lives, and obviously in our professions we do the same. And that's what farmers do as well. Farmers in some countries do fund others to do research. So, that, you know, there are farmers who are in some control of the research process already. In the UK, that's, for example, in the form of levy boards, such as the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. Farmers then do their own research and in groups, in informal groups, experiments, innovations, sharing knowledge. Now, that's happening anyway all over the world. But, you know, in terms of things like the levy boards and farmers being able to fund research, that really only happens in wealthier countries where farmers can afford to do that. And then if we look at research, you know, there is research going on that doesn't necessarily have to be connected to the farming community or the food production community. You know, there's pure and physical life science, pure life science and physical science research going on that is intentionally disconnected. It's quite sort of upstream. It's in laboratories or it's somewhere on a research station. And, you know, there are things going on that don't have to be, you know, necessarily decided on by farmers or citizens. But then what we're really talking about here is applied research. So it's the research which is intentionally meant to be delivering something very close to the coalface. So, you know, applied research could be intending to sell a product. It could be intending to make a profit. The intention could be to increase yields, or the intention could be to support farmers, or there could be many other intentions of that applied research. A lot of that applied research was historically, and a lot of it still is, what we call top-down. So it's the researchers doing some work and then going out and telling the farmers what to do, or whoever their client group might be. And, you know, that's been a bone of contention. You know, we know that happens, again, in wealthier nations, like in the UK. The colonial administrations have sort of promoted that idea in other countries, and development research, you know, over the last few decades has been generally top-down. And that's why people, you know, in the last, say, 20 years have come up with participatory research, so talking about, well, how can we work with farmers, or how can farmers work with us as researchers or other members of that research process. And there's varying degrees of participation from, you know, very nominal participation where farmers might be invited to one meeting at the beginning of the research process to something more farmer-led. And so that idea of participatory research has led to a lot of variants. So we've seen things like farmer field schools commencing in Asia where, you know, really farmers have been getting together and learning with external support, and they're calling and they have expertise coming in as and when they need it. Or as projects on something called Linking Local Learners, that's from Kenya, and various others, you know, around the world. So participatory research has developed into various different applications. But there hasn't been a lot of fundamental change in the way that big budgets operate. And I think that's why, you know, now we're saying, people are saying, that we need to democratise research. The participatory research process isn't enough. It hasn't changed in a fundamental way what's going on. And it seems to be that the reason for that is because of all these different intentions. If you've got an intention to support farmers, it's probably easier for you to do participatory research. But if your intention is to make a profit or sell a product, why do you want to do it with farmers unless you're forced to? So, you know, that's this is the area that hasn't really been addressed. So that's the kind of overview. And then taking this a little bit further in terms of participation and looking at the relationship between participation, farming, scale and approach, and the vested or the interests at stake. So there's this participation ladder on the left, as I mentioned earlier, starting from manipulating or compliance, encouraging the end user group to be compliant with the research, to a situation where farmers might be passive participants, to a situation, a research situation where they might be consulted, where there might be some cooperation or functional participation, and moving up to where there might be actual co-learning between all the partners involved in the research, to the end result or the end status, which might be self-mobilisation of the user group, of the citizen group, where they mobilise themselves and they take collective action. And so those are the different types of participation that we can see. And then trying to relate this to what kind of farming are we talking about? Well, the compliance and manipulation, passive participation works when we're talking about large-scale industrialised agriculture, because we have monocultures, we have systems which are sort of applicable over a wide area. So we can produce one single product that might be used over a wide area. Whereas smaller-scale agroecological approaches really need more of a co-learning approach or self-mobilisation approach, because it's more localised, because we need to find, or whoever's in that region needs to find solutions to their own problems in a smaller area, and it's not going to be universally applicable. So we can see the type of participation or even democratisation has quite a direct relationship with the type of agriculture we're talking about. And that has a direct relation with the interest groups involved. So we can see that the sort of maybe private sector or government sector, which is pushing larger scale industrialised farming, again would prefer that the sort of the lower types of participation, whereas farmers, civil society, interest groups might want the smaller scale agroecological approaches, and that means using a more of a collective action approach to research. So, you know, there's I also question this a bit, because it's not black and white, it's not always like that, and we can always find examples of when it's not like that, and it doesn't always have to be like that either, and it's not necessarily a question of good and bad in itself. I know there are some countries, and you know, we have a guest from Cuba here, but I know there are some examples in Cuba, some really interesting examples of where quite a top-down transfer of technology approach has been used to promote organic pest and disease control inputs. And they're widespread across the country, and it has worked to a reasonable extent. You know, so you can take this approach to promote some agroecological techniques, for example. Now, I'm just going to give you a couple of examples of some projects I've been involved with. And as I said, you know, we haven't really thought about democratising research as such, only in the knowledge that is kind of one of the components of this participatory ladder that we'd like to aim for in a way. But when I talk about we in this particular instance, I mean coming from a research institute and previously an NGO that was also doing research. So this is just a very brief example of a project we've been running in Cuba. Some of you might have heard of it previously here. So it's an intentionally participatory project to tackle the issue of drought in Cuba. There have been successive harvest failures in the east of the country for quite a long time over the last decade because of a severe drought, partly because of climate change, but also because of the previous type of agriculture that had been promoted there before 1990. Now, when we started this, there was talk of, the government was talking about solving the drought problem by building a massive piped water infrastructure across the country from the west of the country, which was wetter, to the east of the country, which was drier. But there wasn't enough money to build that huge infrastructure, so that didn't happen. And then if there had been a private sector solution, and in Cuba there isn't a private sector, but there is an industrialised approach to research there in some areas, so that solution would be the development of drought-resistant crops, and people were working on drought-resistant crops. The solution that my group came up with in partnership with our research partners in Cuba, who were promoting participatory research in their country, was the development of rainwater harvesting and conservation strategies. And that really meant building farmers' capacity to self-mobilise and organise themselves to decide as a group what kind of research they wanted to do, and building their knowledge levels as well on basic issues such as the water cycle. And then supporting on-farm experimentation, on including drought-tolerant varieties, but not only that, also how to capture rainwater and how to improve soil fertility and use of cover crops and techniques like that. And we had a lot of successes with that. I mean, what I called is drought-proofing farms, and in that respect, you know, there are many benefits. You get an increase in farm yields, and this was after 1 year we got these quite positive results. Finances improved of the households, drought wasn't a problem any longer, soil fertility improved, biodiversity improved, nutrition and food security improved, and water is now available for household and livestock. So that was sort of our agroecological approach. But if you'd only used developed drought-tolerant maize in that time, maybe that might have been an industry approach, you'd have had an increase in yields of that particular crop, a decrease in water requirements, your finances would have improved, but you wouldn't have got these other multiple benefits. And the same with if the government had gone ahead with that large-scale infrastructure development. So we can see the differences, but you know, I did ask myself, well, which solution would farmers have chosen if they'd been given that choice in the first place? Because we didn't offer them that choice. We only offered them the agroecological approach. And with Cuban partners who were promoting that. So we offered farmers a basket of choices, as we call it. But I know from my previous work in the same country that quite a few farmers might have opted for the option on the left. So, you know, who is choosing what kind of support we're making to farmer groups, even when we're trying to be participatory and democratic? And the second example, just briefly, is about a project I'm working on in Uganda about diversifying incomes through the production and export of berry fruits. And this is a collaborative project between Tropical Whole Foods, which is a UK company, you've probably come across them. They produce these fruit and nut bars, they produce mueslis and dried fruit in most of the health shops. And one of their long-term partners, they've been working for years, is a company called Fruits of the Nile. It's a cooperative in Uganda with about 1,400 farmer members. And we were called in when they were putting in a bid to DFID, which they won, a public-private partnership bid for some funding to try and diversify the product range of these farmers. And the rationale was that if you can produce, if you can get a fair trade certification for temperate berry fruits, it'll be very high value in the UK market because nobody in the UK can get fair trade labelling for strawberries and raspberries or any other berry fruit. So if we can produce those temperate fruits in the tropics, there'll be a niche market in the UK for them, which will mean that farmers who are producing them will get a higher price, and with an organic certification as well. So that was the rationale behind it. And the Fruits of the Nile helped to initiate the idea, write the concept note, write the project application. They've been in it from the start, and they have this very strong relationship with their UK partners. So you could say it's quite a solid democratic basis for a research project. And we were called in to help out on the selection, planting and trialling of these berry fruits on 10 of the members' farms all over the country. We were involved in various activities, some of which were undertaken in the UK, but some of which included assessment of the farm sites, including soil and water testing, demonstration and training and the trial design, fruit planting and maintenance. And the training, the Fruits of the Nile Extension officers in things like plant storage and maintenance, monitoring and data recording, and establishment of a farmer learning group. So we still had this kind of, it felt a bit like a top-down process, thank you. So there we are, you know, working in the field, but it still felt quite top down. Some challenges that we encountered in this included the commitment of farmers. Even though the setup seemed to have been quite democratic, there were still some issues with, for example, commitment of the trial farmers in maintaining these crops, which they really wanted to grow. So just because it seems to be quite a democratic process, it doesn't mean we don't still encounter some of the challenges that we do in research and development anyway. And the third example I'm just going to give is a project in the UK which was undertaken by Garden Organic, which was the Henry Doubleday Research Association. I was working there for a while, and this project was looking at the management of weeds in a participatory research approach. DEFRA funded it, which was quite innovative and forward-looking of DEFRA. Don't lie. And So we have approached about learning from and gathering knowledge related to weed management from organic farmers. There was a review of scientific literature, so researchers were undertaking some of the activities. Others of the activities included researcher-led trials, and then there were also farmer-led trials. So we had both types of trials, and knowledge dissemination, focus groups, field walks. So quite a range of activities where farmers and researchers were participating together. And some of the key points that came out of that work, a lot of farmers were really interested to participate in this project. When invitations were sent out, about 200 farmers responded, plus other researchers and advisors around the country. When farmers were asked how they would like to participate, some offered to provide information, others offered their farms as trial sites, and others offered to form focus groups to discuss issues. And a lot of the methodologies that were used were drawn from our research experience in southern countries, because this hadn't been done before in the UK very much. Outputs include this website, which is a really good website if anyone has a weed problem. I'd recommend you look at it. A book, some farmers' feedback. Farmers are saying, we could have done it without the project, but probably wouldn't have done. So, you know, the project did seem to help. However, DEFRA wasn't interested in supporting the continuation of this project, and they haven't really, as far as I know, been involved in supporting a lot more participatory projects in the UK. And then finally, I said that, you know, I'm not involved a lot in going further with democratising agricultural research, but there are two groups and individuals who are in the UK, as well as my colleagues here on the platform, and I've just wanted to mention them. Some of you will know about them already, and I've spoken to them and they said yes, do please give them a mention. And the one that probably you will know of is Michelle Pimber at IIED, who's done a lot of work and really been introducing this concept of democratisation into food and agricultural research. She has a website with his work on it, and he aims to make the voices of small-scale producers and other excluded citizens heard in the governance and process of agricultural research. And there is going to be a high-level policy dialogue here, supported by the APPG on agroecology, 1st to 3rd of February next year. The second group who are working on this issue in the UK is a project called Our Food, and that's by Tom Wakefield and Tom McMillan, who some of you may know of. And their rationale is, you know, the UK government spends £400 million a year of public money on research, and obviously the food companies spend a lot more, spend billions on research, and who's deciding? Who's deciding that research agenda? You know, when the government isn't regulating, we hear recently the government isn't regulating their energy sector in terms of the amount of profit they're making, because the government says it wants the energy sector to invest that profit into research, into renewable energy. So if we look at the food sector, with the profits they're making, are they investing it into something that's for the public good? And, you know, who knows, or, you know, what is going on? So that project is planned to inform citizens and to make science accountable to the people it serves, to put the land and people and land back into the heart of UK farming and food research. So, you know, I'll just ask the question again, democratising research, how far can we as citizens go? You know, we've all got our own professional roles and jobs, but, you know, if we see ourselves as citizens and look at it from that perspective, how far do we want to be involved in research? What kind of decisions would we make? Do we have enough knowledge to make an informed decision? Or what kind of knowledge might we want if we want to make a more informed decision? An old sort of trade unionist, James Larkin from Ireland, in the last century was quoted as saying, "The ultimate solution is the ownership and control of the means of life by the whole of the people, but we are not at that stage of development yet." So who decides who's not at what stage of development as well? Is it the government? You know, how much participation by governments and outside agencies does the community need to address its own aspirations? So there are still some questions that we need to ask ourselves and to sort of think about with this. And, you know, I'm just sort of starting to think about it myself, so... Thank you very much. Thank you.